All right. What we look at now is we're, of course, wrapping up this section. The invitation section will begin in verse 13, as I perceive it to be. So we have 12 more verses that continue this thought about the righteousness of the kingdom. And in verses 1 through 5, Jesus talks about not being full of hypocrisy, or not being the play actor, if you will, which of course we know is the root meaning of the word hypocrite. A very often misunderstood, but very often quoted verse 1. Judge not that you be not judged. And when that's usually thrown around by so many people, that's usually done in what sort of context? Why would people say this or quote this verse so much? That's right. You cannot, because Jesus said, judge not that you be not judged. So you can't judge. I'm not going to judge you, so you can't judge me. So we'll just drop it and go on our merry little ways separately. Many interpret this to forbid all sorts of, or all types of judgments. That can't be so, because look later in this chapter. We haven't gotten there yet, but look at verses 15 and 16. In the invitation section, Jesus pronounces a warning. Who does He warn about? False prophets. He says, beware of false prophets who will come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. Now, if you can't make a judgment, if all judgments are forbidden, then how can you do what He says to do in verse 15? It would be impossible. You will know them by their fruits, and thus can judge them by their teaching or actions elsewhere. So we know that this cannot forbid all judgment, because it would contradict what He says later in the same chapter. That just won't harmonize one against the other. I think we can see that. How else could we determine a false prophet? We have to make a judgment on what they teach. We have to judge what they teach, what we hear, against what the Word of God says in other places. So what Jesus is condemning, of course, we know, is look in verse 5. And I think even before you get to verse 5, what's the first word? He says, hypocrite. There's your clue. But even before getting to verse 5, look at verse 2. I think there's another inclination that we're talking about. What does He tell us in verse 2 about this judgment? All right. Whatever standard you use to judge others, the same will be applied to you. So if you set the standard or the bar so high for other people, then you better be prepared to be held accountable to the same level, if you will. And sometimes we don't get that very good, do we? as a general rule, sometimes we're very hard on other people, and also want at the same time to cut ourselves a lot of slack. And that's not the right way to go about this. Whatever standard we use, verse 2 again makes it clear that we choose to use for others will be using against us, and Jesus makes that very clear. So how does He illustrate this? And to me, this is one of the more humorous parts of the Bible. Jesus talks in verses 3 and 4. Let's read those. Round 3, verses 3 and 4 for us, and then we'll discuss its meaning. Now, is it wrong to try to remove the splinter or the speck out of your brother's eye? No, that'd be a commendable thing. Trying to be helpful. Trying to help someone with a problem or some issue. But the concern is what, Jesus says. You may be worse off than he is, that's right. He's got a little splinter in his, you got a big tuba for coming out of your head or your eye. So thus you can see the silliness of that kind of thinking. And that's it. It's blatant hypocrisy, exactly what it is. So if you're going to help the brother who's got the splinter or the little speck, it's okay to help him, but first, he says, do what? That's right. You can't even see to help your brother if you've got this big log coming out of your own face. So first, take care of self. Then that puts you in a better position to help your brother, or help the other man, help the other person. Remove the tube before out of your own eye before trying to remove the splinter. I just use modern-day words instead of speck and speck and plank. It's 2x4 and splinter. It's the same idea. But we see the exaggeration of one's own sins versus he's trying to nitpick and see the small, tiny things in other people, and he won't take care of the big, glaring problems in his own life. And Jesus says that's utter hypocrisy. Yes, Brother Lambert. Well, yeah. Yes. Right. That's correct. And people can spot a hypocrite a mile away. I mean, anybody can do that. So the idea is not about being perfect. The idea is about when you have something glaring in your own life and it's easily seen by other people, and then you want to go around and you want to help other people with their problems, that's not received too well, and it really is just hypocritical. Yes. Well, okay. Yes, I can see that. I don't think that really fits the context, though. I mean, Jesus is talking about being the helper who has a more glaring problem than the one who needs being helped. But I see what you're saying also. People should not refuse being helped because they don't want to be helped. Maybe going back to verse 1, don't judge me, don't help me because you're not perfect yourself either. But I think the context is when we have something worse off in ourselves, helping someone else. So be mindful of our own sins. This goes exactly with Galatians 6 and verse 2. Consider thyself, lest thou also be tempted. You know, trying to restore such a one. Those who are spiritual, restore the one that's fallen away. But don't forget about yourself. You can be tempted with the same pitfalls that he has. And I want you to look. I didn't really put this in the material, but look back at 2 Samuel 11. David illustrates what is so common among all of us. This is one of the more familiar Old Testament stories. When David committed adultery with Bathsheba, lay with her, got her pregnant, and he went through all those steps, he went to all that trouble to hide or conceal his sin. Trying to get the man drunk, trying to get him to come home and lay with his own wife to hide her pregnancy. Then at the last, all those little methods did not work. He had no other alternative, as he saw it, but that had him murdered, had him killed. And so he did, and then he married her. The last phrase in chapter 11, the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. David thought he was no doubt he was home free. Got it covered, got it all taken care of. But, of course, God was aware of everything. Now, we get to chapter 12, and who was it that God dispatched to talk to David? Who did he send? He sent the prophet. He sent Nathan the prophet, and Nathan didn't come busting in the door and with his Bible and preaching away. He told him a little story, didn't he? Told him a little parable. And David did not know he was going to hang himself. I'm sure he just told this story. Now, what was the quick gist of the story he told, this little parable. All right, rich man had plenty, had a guest, had company, he was going to feed the guy, and had so much to choose from his own flock, but he was unwilling to use what he already had, so he went out and took the little ewe lamb, the only lamb the other poor man had, to serve his guest. Now, of course, in the parable, who's the rich man? That'd been David. Who was the poor man? That'd been Uriah. All Uriah had was the love of his life, which was Bathsheba. But David was not willing to be content with what he had. He went and took her also. Now, going through that little story, what was David's reaction to the parable? We're not standing for this. This is awful. David's anger was greatly aroused, verse 5. And said, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die. Now watch it, David. You're going to die. And he shall restore fourfold for the lamb, because he did this thing and because he had no pity. Well, that's all David said. Did what David say, was it true? Was it right? It was justice, wasn't it? It was right. But David did not know that he had just hung himself. And then those famous words from Nathan. You are the man. It's you, David. See, what David shows us, what David reminds us of, is that we have this quick tendency to see the sins in other people so easily, so that to us they're so glaring, and we tend to forget that we may be guilty of something even greater ourselves. And we don't need to be going around judging other people, condemning other people. Not that we can't make judgments. We can make judgments if it's based upon the standard, based upon what God says. But David shows us how it's just so easy that we can do that so many times in our life in given situations. And I think we see that's how that would go. No, it was not just a parable, not just a story. You're correct. He did not know. He had just indicted himself in that. Okay. All right. Copier guy just left. I'm giving him a thumbs up. He's working on the machine here. Okay. Anything else through verse 5? 7, 1 through 5. There was two quick questions about that. Now, look, we get to the top of page 15. And one other way that we think about, see this idea of kingdom righteousness that Jesus has been emphasizing, when we see it to relation or in relation to sharing the kingdom with others, and not just sharing it with them, but seeking it for ourselves. We'll see that at least, I think, through verse 12. Now, the first thing Jesus gives us, this is question 22, what words of wisdom does Jesus give us with respect to sharing the kingdom, trying to teach other people, or sharing these great truths with others? What's he tell us? All right. There are several uninterested people out there. We need to be busy sharing the kingdom, yes, but we're going to come into contact with, and he mentions how are others described in what two ways in verse 6? They're dogs and hogs. Dogs and swine. All right. Now, I don't think he means in the term the dogs. It's not like a little house pet, like butterscotch. Just a cute little thing. Now, these were the snarling, ravenous dogs of Palestine, maybe along the lines of coyotes or wolves. I mean, they were beasts. And they would just soon turn on anybody who even tried to give them something to eat. They'd just turn on them because they're just that mentality. Then, of course, the hogs or the swine, never appreciative of anything other than slop. That's all they want, and they don't assign any high value to that which is good. It's just to be eaten or trampled upon. So the kingdom cannot be forced, is what I think he's saying. It cannot be forced onto anyone who does not desire it. And if they don't appreciate it or if they despise truth or don't appreciate it, we must recognize them for what they are, that is, dogs and swine. And so the warning in verse 6, he says, do not give what is holy to the dogs. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't try to teach everybody. We need to try to teach everybody. But after a while, what can sometimes become painfully obvious? They're not interested. They're just not going to be interested. Well, someone says, well, but you know, we've got to keep trying. I mean, every soul is worth repeated efforts. Well, that is true. But if you keep going to the dogs and the hogs, that means you can't do what? You can't go to someone else who may be more receptive and who may have a more willing ear or a more good and honest heart, as the Bible phrase is. Absolutely. That's right, Brother Wayne. On two different occasions, Paul said to Jewish audiences, your blood be on your own heads, we turn to the Gentiles. We're going to go to someone else who might be more receptive. Now, obviously, what if we learn later on that those that we previously identified as hogs and dogs, that they maybe have a more willing ear now? Well, we can go back, absolutely. We can go back and maybe try again. But each person will decide for him or herself. And if they show themselves to be unwilling or uninterested, do not cast your pearls before the swine. Hogs can't appreciate pearls. They know nothing about it. And the dogs will just uh, will just gobble you up, or they'll treat you contemptuously. The Lord says, do not. I don't want to use the word wasting time, but time spent on them would be a waste. If we know of others who are more receptive, we need to go on and try and teach other people. So these undiscerning individuals are content with vile things of the world. I asked the question here, last part of question 22. When you consider what Peter wrote in 2 Peter chapter 2, in one of these New Testament passages that oftentimes if you're having a study or discussion with someone who denies that one can be lost after he or she has been saved, this is one of those passages that you can go to that will show that one can fall away. Do you see any significance? I asked this question to the what two animals does Peter use in 2 Peter 2 and verse 22? Well, he used dogs and the swine. That's right. The dog will return to its own vomit. Dogs do that. I don't know why dogs do that, but they do. And the hog, you can give the sow a bath, put her in the county fair, make her a blue ribbon, and she'll go right back and make her a first-class mud hole. That's the first thing she wants to do. That's just all they know. So some people show themselves to be that way, and they're going to reject the holy things of God. And the Lord says, if that is determined and if that is clear, then don't spend your time there any longer. Try to find someone else who may be a little more receptive. And these are words of wisdom in terms of sharing the kingdom with other people. That section only gets one verse. Starting in verse 7, this is question 23, he now turns around and discusses about seeking the kingdom for ourselves. Sharing is one thing, but what about seeking it for yourself? Verses 7 through 11. Again, remember the work that we do before we leave this point. We are salt and we're light. There's the passage that Brother Lambert mentioned a few moments ago. Paul says on those two occasions, I'm going to turn the Gentiles to the Jews. And also Matthew 10 and verse 14 addresses the same kind of attitude or the same kind of inclination. All right, now, let's discuss seeking the kingdom for ourselves. He says in verse 7, what three things does he encourage? Ask, seek, and knock. That's right, Angela. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek, look for it, hunt for it, and you'll find it. Knock, and the door will be opened unto you. The verbs here are present active. And in the Greek, that means it's continual action. So when he says, ask, seek, and knock, he's saying, keep on asking. You keep on seeking. You keep on knocking. It's not a one-time thing. Well, I asked today and I knocked and nobody answered, so I'm going to go. No, you got to keep asking. You got to keep seeking. It's a lifetime process. Not just one time or one day, but a continual thing. And that tells us, again, that the life of the Christian, or the Christian life as it sometimes is styled, is a lifetime commitment. It's a lifelong journey. It's not just something that we do on separate occasions. It's something that we always do. There is never a time that we don't need to be asking and seeking and knocking. That's done every single day. Now, that's to the individual, verse 7. Jesus then sort of changes the perspective, I think, starting in verse 8, about the same idea of asking and seeking and knocking. But now he goes to the other side and talks about God's perspective in that. What about the one who does the asking and the seeking and the knocking? What about God's view of that situation? I think that's where he's going to be addressing now. Verses 8 through 11. Everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be open. What man is there among you who, if his son asks for bread, will he give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will he give him a snake or a serpent? If you then, being evil, that's caused some people to have a little difficulty with this passage. But it's just said in contrast. If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask Him? There's the perspective from the divine side of this situation. So those who seek first the kingdom, He just said in chapter 6 and verse 33, seek the kingdom. Well, those who seek the kingdom, they will be rewarded. And Jesus reassures us of the truthfulness of His words by reminding us that God is better than any earthly father. How many earthly fathers do not give? Well, I know they're out there. Let's not pretend that they don't exist. But by and large, most earthly fathers, what will they do by their children? They will give them what they need. I know there's deadbeat dads are out there and deadbeat moms are out there too. But by and large, earthly parents, they love their children and they'll provide for them and they'll give them what they need. I'm going to give them what they want, but they'll give them what they need. And the Lord says, now if you know that, if you understand that, and you being evil, if you see that, then what do you think your father thinks in heaven when his children come asking and seeking and knocking the things of the kingdom? Well, he'll give you what you need. He'll make sure that you have exactly what you need, that God is better than any earthly father. We don't need to misunderstand this reassurance. If someone says, well, this is like Aladdin's lamp. Boy, I ask and you get it. All right, I'm asking for a Ferrari. I'm asking for a great big house. I'm asking for a lot of money in the bank. Well, that may seem rather cavalier and flippant to you, but there, you know, some have that kind of idea about it. You hear some of these TV preachers, that's the kind of things they talk about, asking and those kinds of notions. Well, obviously, this gets us to question 24. There is a caveat here. Yes. That's right. They get it from you if you watch their broadcast and send them money. That's right, Bill. Okay, so this isn't a blank check. It's not Aladdin's lamp. Our asking must be in faith. Let's turn to James 1. These two verses here, James 1 and 1 John 5, I think, really address this really well. James chapter 1. And we're going to read verses 5 through 8. Angela, when you have that, would you read those four verses for us, please? James 1, 5 through 8. Now, if you look at verse 5 of what she just read, that sounds a lot like Matthew 7, doesn't it? Makes a lot of the same points. But James's next statement, verse 6, but about this asking, God gives liberally. And God is this Father who wants His children to have what they need. He'll give it liberally and without reproach. But let him ask in faith. Asking in faith is the key, obviously. And it also must be, as we see from 1 John 5, let's look at there now, 1 John 5, verses 14 and 15, kind of reemphasizes what James said, asking in faith, I believe, is harmonized with 1 John 5, 14 and 15. Fred, if you have that, read those two verses for us. Alright, so as John puts it, especially in verse 14, if we ask anything, what's the condition? According to His will. It's got to be according to the will of God. Now, do we always know what the will of God is? No, we don't. We know a lot of the will of God because He's told us. We have it revealed for us. But there are a lot of things that work in our lives that we just don't know what the Lord's will is. And so, we might pour our hearts out in prayer about this. We may ask God. We may be diligent. Back to Matthew 7. We may be diligent in asking and seeking and knocking. We may spend the whole day doing that. And you know what? It may not be God's will that be granted to us. We may be convinced that's the very thing we need. I can convince myself of almost anything. I can do that. But that may not be what the Lord wants me to have. And sometimes the answer is no. That's the divine answer. Yes. That's right. we can make up our minds and we're trying to convince God that this is what I need to have, and you know that it doesn't work that way. You didn't hear what Bill said. Preacher went to move somewhere and said, I'm going to pray about this. You go upstairs and pack and we'll get ready to go. Well, then, you know, why even pray about it? If the mind's already made up, then, you know, what's the point of seeking God's will about it? I think that's a good illustration. So many times a child will ask something of a parent that is denied. Parents will say no because, well, little Johnny, little Susan, that's not in your best interest. Of course, they can say all day long, but that's what I want. Well, I understand that you want that. I have no problem understanding that. But what you don't understand is that I know you don't need that. So, as the parent, since I know more than you and I'm responsible for you, then the answer is no. And that needs to be the end of that. And that's the same idea here with us and this it's the needs versus the wants argument, obviously. Now, to illustrate, well-known passage here, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. This is the last part of chapter of question 24. 2 Corinthians 12, and we want to look at verses 7 through 10. Another verse that you know really well. Shirley, would you read for us, please, 2 Corinthians 12, verses 7 through 10. What was Paul convinced about? Paul was convinced of something. Well, at the end he was, but at the start of this passage, what was Paul convinced of? And we know that because of what he did in verse 8. Now, he was given this thorn in the flesh to keep from being exalted above measure. But Paul was convinced, listen, I'll be a whole lot better off if I don't have whatever this is. I can do a whole lot more. This is sort of holding me back. So he prayed not just once, not just twice. He knocked. He sought. He asked three times. And I'm convinced that Paul was convinced. I'll be a lot better off if I don't have this. Now, if he didn't think that, why would he pray three times about it? I mean, he wanted to get rid of it. But what did he have to learn? Even an apostle. Listen, Paul, all you need, verse 9, is what? What I give you, and that is my grace. My grace is all you need. For my strength is made perfect in weakness. So therefore, Paul had to learn, as he concludes in verse 9, rather than ask to be shed of these infirmities or these thorns in the flesh, what's Paul going to do about them? I'm going to boast in them, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. So therefore I take pleasure in iniquities or in infirmities and reproaches. For in Christ's sake, when I'm really weak, that's when I'm really strong. So this is the wants versus the needs. And Jesus, again, is commending us, telling us, exhorting us, be busy asking, be busy seeking, be busy knocking all the time. Keep in mind, though, the caveats from James 1 and 1 John 5. It's got to be in accordance with the will of God. It's got to be in harmony with this. But even things that might fall within that caveat, you can ask, you can seek, you can knock, but God still may say, no. Focus on other things. I've given you as the loving Father. Again, back to Matthew 7. This is verses 8 through 11. The Father knows what the children need, and He'll give us what we need. And we need to be happy and content with that. Yes, sir. Well, that's true. And again, that's the point Jesus is saying. If you being evil, in contrast to the Holy Father, if you know what your children need and give it to them on a constant basis, if you can understand that, then don't you think the Father in heaven knows what you need? He's perfect. He's omniscient. And He'll grant you what you need. Yes. No, that's true. So it would be true with things that they need. It could be true with discipline. It could be true with lots of things. But the point is, when we seek the kingdom for ourselves, right, we need to be content with what God gives us. Ask according to His will, but know that He knows what we need best, obviously. So that takes us at least down through question 24, which is the 11th verse of chapter 7. Now, to conclude this section of the sermon, verse 12, the Bible doesn't call it this, but we've come to call it this phrase. We give it the title of the Golden Rule. Right? Verse 12 of chapter 7 says, "Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets." Here's the standard, if you will, in terms of sharing and seeking the kingdom for ourselves. We've come to call it the Golden Rule. God's unselfish love and concern and caring for us. How has God been thoughtful of us? He sent His Son. Verses 9 through 11, again, just previous. Also, Romans chapter 5 comes to mind when you think about those great verses that are there. That should motivate us in how we treat other people. But sadly, there may not be a more least practiced verse in the whole sermon than this one. Because sometimes we don't do a very good job of this. Sometimes we practice the rule, do to others before they do to you. We kind of beat them to the punch. Or we don't treat them as we want them to treat us, obviously. Selfishness gets in the way. And just a couple of thought questions. How many personal relationships would be improved if this rule were practiced, do you think? Marriage, friendships, parent-to-child-parent relationships. Just think of all of them. And if we just take it upon ourselves, I'm going to practice this rule. I may not get it much in return back my way. Very seldom may I get it. But this is how I'm going to react to everybody else. Then think how they would be improved or bettered in one way or another. How many local churches would see less problems if brethren acted this way? How many less issues would elderships have to fool with, contend with, if brethren would act this way? See, just everything gets improved if we follow this rule that Jesus talks about here in the kingdom. Yeah, prisons would be empty. Okay, all right. Go on. Yes, that's right. Very good. A lot of social ills would just be corrected. Wouldn't be the marriage and divorce problems. On and on we could go with that kind of thing. Well, leave the doors unlocked. That's right. He says this rule is the law and the prophets. Now, what's he mean by that? Well, what it means is it summarizes and fulfills what is found in the first covenant. Leviticus 19, verse 18, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." What's that? That's the golden rule. That's the same thing. And when Jesus was asked, what's the greatest commandment? All right. And he said, and the second is like it. What did he say? He quoted that verse right there. That's right. Thou shalt love a neighbor as thyself. And Romans 13, we'll close with that. Romans 13, verses 9 and 10 on this particular section. Listen to what Paul says there. Romans 13, verse 9. Well, let's start in verse 8. He says, owe no man anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, and he lists some here. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not murder. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, namely, and he quotes Leviticus 19, verse 18, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, he says, love is the fulfillment of the law. It is the law and the prophets. It is the basic message of the Scripture. The love that God has for man, the love that man should have for God, the love that man should have for his fellow man, and how we treat one another. So that is how he concludes this particular section in terms of sharing and seeking the kingdom. Okay, anything else through lesson 4 that anybody had a comment about or a question? All right, we'll go to lesson 5. Now this is page 16. And we have come pretty much to the end of the preaching. The preaching is over for the most part. With this statement in verse 12, do unto others as you'd have them do to you. That was the end of the sermon. All that's left now is the invitation. So he has outlined, let's look at what he's done real quickly. He's outlined what is expected of citizens in the kingdom. He talked about, remember, the Beatitudes, that's your calling. That's how you're described. He talked about your work, that is the similitude. You're to be salt and light. Great discussion about that. Chapter 5, verse 17 through 6, verse 18, and also the first 5 verses of chapter 7. Jesus explained what true kingdom righteousness is. Not the shallow self-righteousness of the Jews. That's not it. Remember, they were pompous. They were arrogant. They did things to be seen of men and to be rewarded by men. Jesus says, what I'm telling you to do goes a whole lot deeper and a whole lot better than that. It's more meaningful than that. He talked about anxious worry and trusting God in chapter 6. Don't be anxious. Don't worry about things. This is where the Gentiles fail. This is the treasure that they seek. And then in this passage we just got through talking about, he exhorts, asking and seeking and knocking, trying to always be in pursuit of the will of God and treating other people as you would want to be treated. So having discussed all those things, all that's left now is the invitation. And any good sermon has an invitation. And this one is no different. In fact, it's the best. The best sermon preached by the best preacher, if you will. Truth can be powerfully presented in ways that really speak to people. And the object of preaching, I'm currently studying with a young man who wants to be a better preacher. And I'm trying to tell him, trying to teach him, that, you know, preaching is meant to move people from where they are to where they need to be. That's why we preach. It's not meant to show how much the preacher knows, whether it's a lot or a little. That's not the point of preaching. It's to move people, get them to change where they need to change. So truth can be presented very powerfully. But at last, the preacher, even this preacher here, he cannot compel his audience. He cannot force them. All he can do is ask them to comply. What I've taught you, I want you to consider it thoughtfully, soberly, and then consider making it your will. Consider making it your very character. And so Jesus cannot compel either. God can compel man, but then he ceases to be this fair and just God. All he can do is offer it. And then the decision is ours whether or not we avail ourselves of it one way or another. Now in the invitation, starting at verse 13 through verse 27, that's the last words Jesus speaks. 28 and 29 of Matthew 7 just kind of give us the reaction of the sermon. That's what lesson 6 is. So lesson 5 is this invitation. He contrasts the invitation, the two different options, if you will, in 4 different ways. Sort of not to make it repetitive, but it's to emphasize it 3 other different ways other than where he offers it the first time, verses 13 and 14, with the two roads or the two paths that one may take. He wants the hearers, that is, those whom he spoke it to in that day, but also us too, to consider these choices. They are eternal choices. with a lot hanging in the balance of whether or not we accept the right way or the consequences of taking the wrong choice with what he's outlined in his sermon. Roads that lead to life or death. It is fruit that is either good or bad. That's the second of the four. The third of the four he mentions is that we have either respect or disregard for divine authority. And of course, the fourth one is, how is it either stand or fall in the storm? That's his invitation, offered four different ways. And we'll consider them each separately. First is verses 13 and 14. This is the two roads. Right? Matthew 7, verse 13. Enter by the narrow gate. For wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it, or many there be that travel that way. Because narrow is the gate, or straight is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. That's the first aspect of his invitation. The first words, though, are an appeal. Before he even describes the two ways, the first appeal he makes is what? What's he say? Enter by the narrow. Choose the narrow way. Choose the straight gate. Now, that's what I want you to do. That's what you need to do. He says that first. The narrow, I've asked you in question one, last part of question one, define narrow or straight. What's that word mean? Difficult. Restrictive. Some dictionaries say it maybe even compressed. It's just so confined as opposed to something that's, you know, full-blown, wide open, so forth, easier to travel. Now, the Lord is saying, I want you to pick the harder way. Choose to travel the more restrictive, confined, restrictive, narrower way. That's what he's appealing to us. Agony is involved in this, and let me show you that. Turn to Luke 13. This is a parallel passage of the sermon. Luke's, some rendering of the sermon on the Mount is rendered a little differently than what Matthew records for us. Neither is it all in the same place. Luke 13, look at verse 24. Jesus would teach these things at other places also, not just didn't teach at one time, but he taught them elsewhere. Luke 13, 24 says, strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able. That word strive in Luke 13:24 in the Greek is agonizomai. And in that word you hear our English word agonize. Luke of Jude verse 3. Contend for the faith. It's the same word in the Greek. So with agony we have to contend for the faith. And with difficulty, with agony, we will find the narrow gate. Now, I didn't ask this in the material. How about the Bible says that the way of the transgressor is hard? The Bible say that? It says that. Well, then, how can you harmonize that with this? I'm not trying to start an argument or nothing. I just want you to think with me about this. Well, different goals were involved. That's true. I think that's the best way to put that. It's not that the way of the sinner is not hard. I mean, it is hard. It's a hard way to live. Life is hard, and it'll end in total failure. But as Ralph points out, the way that Jesus encourages here, it may be a very unpleasant way. But how does it work out? Good. It works out the way that you need to go. That's the difference. So this is the harder way to travel. But it's worth the trip because of the outcome that's there. The way of the transgressor is hard in that it ends up as a total failure and such a great disappointment. Jesus recommends a very uninviting way. Now, that's a play on words. This is the invitation. But Jesus is saying, choose the way that is the least appealing. What do you think about that? Only a person with conviction and only a person who's got his head screwed on straight will see that. The world thinks that's nonsense, that's foolish. And they're missing the point, obviously. That's what Jesus is inviting here. Now, the first way is described, the last half of verse 13, this narrow, or this broad way. How's he described it? It's wide. Many's going. It's the path that leads to destruction. It's broad with a wide gate. It's the opposite of the way that he recommended. He didn't endorse this way at all. That's right. That's right. Now, I've asked this question, thought question, depending on how one looks at this question too. Is there anything appealing about traveling this road? Well, depending on your perspective, it could be appealing. It's easier to travel. It's less restrictive. Now, I don't want anybody cramping my style. The world says, you know, they put God in that. I want God to tell me what I can and can't do. I'm going to be my own person. And you'll have lots of company. You'll have plenty to travel with. Because many will be on that path. Now, that's not really appealing to us, but some might find that appealing, depending on how they look at things. Absolutely. There are pleasures involved. That's the last part of question three. Freddie, you're right. Absolutely. Someone says, well, you know, living is about doing what comes naturally. Well, if you do what comes naturally, what road will you be on? You'll be on that one. You just react like a dumb animal. Dogs do what comes naturally. Cats and other animals just do what comes naturally. Generally speaking, hasn't man historically displayed an inclination always to do whatever is the easiest? Man will always choose the path of least resistance. Whether that's on the job, whether that's in school, whether that's in all your relationships, just do whatever's the easiest. I don't want to do any more than I have to, kind of thinking. Well, that's that road. That's traveling that way. And that's not the way that Jesus recommends, obviously. This easier path will not end up well. It ends up with certain death and destruction. So it may look very inviting. It's easier to travel the broader way. It's more forgiving. I don't mean that in the sense of God's forgiveness, but you can make all the mistakes that's out there and still not fall off the road or leave the path. It's very, very forgiving, if you will. But it won't end up well. And now Freddie's point. Any joy while traveling it is only fleeting. Talking about Moses in Hebrews 11. He forsook the treasures of Egypt. And he did not enjoy what? The passing or fleeting. Yes, there's pleasures, but they're momentary. They're fleeting. Do we want to live our lives and all we have to show for it is, yeah, but you know, I had a lot of fun when traveling that way. Well, okay, you may have had fun. You may have had fun while traveling that path. But when you get to the end of it, when you've traveled and you can't go anymore, then where's the fun? Well, it's not there. That's the dead end road. Peter says to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. These pleasurable things in the end will wind up killing us. They'll destroy us. That's what Jesus is saying. So, yes, you can have fun on that road. You most certainly can. I actually heard someone say one time he put it, but the gist of his statement was that there's no pleasure in sin. Well, I don't know how somebody can say that. I mean, that's just not so. If there's no pleasure, then Hebrews 11 is made out to be a liar. And plus, why would people do it then if there's no fun to it? Where's the temptation, obviously? So there's pleasure there, but it's, of course, it's carnal pleasure, fleshly, physical pleasure. Now, yeah. Well, these folks don't know what you're talking about. If the road's up there, okay. Ralph will know. Okay. That's true. Whatever road you choose to take, if you're looking for pleasure only on that trip, then you're going to be sadly disappointed. Because there's more to it than that. And it ends up in destruction. Now, the second way he describes in verse 14. How does he describe this way? All right. Narrow is the gate. Again, a repetition of the first part of verse 13. Narrow gate. More restrictive way. It's narrow with a smaller gate. Now, this can be, again, this is the last half of question four. It can be discouraging, again, based on one's perspective. Not that it is, but it can be. For what reason? Well, it's more restrictive. It's more demanding. Someone once said this statement that Christianity, and I mean that in the New Testament sense, Christianity is a thinking man's religion. And that's true. You have to use your head. If all you use is just your fleshly senses and what appeals to the flesh, then you're living like the brute beast of the field. But you have to use your head. You have to think about these things. It's harder to travel, more restrictive, more demanding. What about your company you're going to have? Well, what about your fellow travelers? Well, you have a whole lot of company. And you know, sometimes you may even have to travel alone. Is that possible? Even without your own family. Jesus said, "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me." The gospel may come to an entire household and only one person to take it. And I've been there. I know what that's like. Some of you may have also. It's not pleasant. But you have to say, but the journey is worth it. What the Lord is offering makes this tolerable, makes this bearable. So not many companions will go. You may have to even travel alone if that be the case. Now those who dare choose the harder path, they will be glad they did. They'll be very glad they did. In the end, it ends in life, totally. But to travel this way requires, this is question, last part of question 5. Remember, back in chapter 5 and verse 8, "Blessed are the pure in heart." We said that was the singleness of heart, complete devotion. Having the single eye, Matthew 6, 19 to 24. Not being double-minded, but being completely committed to this way. You have to have it to travel this way. It's required. You can't travel it any other way. Now, Jesus will later repeat His characterizations about the few and the many in some of His parables. Many are called, but few are chosen. How many are called? Well, everybody's called. But only few answer. Only few take up the invitation. So we don't need to be shocked by the numbers. The Lord tells us up front, this is the reality of these things. Yes, sir. Yeah, the remnant. That's right. Small piece. That's right. The remnant. Not everybody. Only 8. That's right. That's right. That's right. Now, just to summarize this, what we've been discussing, let's look at these two quick comparisons. And this isn't saying anything new, just to, again, go over it again. The wide gate, the broad way that He first talked about. Well, it's easy, and it's unrestricted. Not many difficulties that are there. There's room for every kind of opinion out there. Think what you want, I'll think what I want. There's room for that on the broad way. No problem. It's man does what comes naturally. Superficial hypocrisy is the norm. We talked about some of that in this sermon. There's room for that on that road. Doesn't bother me. I'm on my part of the road. You're on your part of the road, and there's room for that. You'll have lots of company, but you'll end up dead and destroyed. Now, by contrast, let's talk about the narrow or the straight gate. It's difficult. It's restricted. Hard to travel, straight, narrow. Boundaries are there that are marked by the revealed will of God. There's not room for this, for every opinion of what I think, what you know. It's what does God think about this. That's what sets the boundaries. That's what makes the way so restrictive. And I've got to be able to have the mindset to adapt to that. And you'll have few companions, but you'll end up alive. Now, the question is, which road are you going to take? Which road am I going to take? Jesus invites you to take a road. To live is to travel. And you cannot not make a choice. You've got to make a choice. There's no third option. Well, can I have a kind of a hybrid between them? No, there's no hybrid answer. It's one or the other. And to not choose is to choose, isn't it? He that is not with me. Now, what road will the Lord be on? Well, he'll be on this one down here. So if you don't choose to follow Him, then you're going to be on that one up there. That's just the way that goes. Yes, Brother Lynn. Yes. 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 That's right. Taking up the cross, making sacrifices. That's absolutely true. Now, before we end, we're going to stop with this today. Let me ask a couple of reverse thought questions. Those who have transformed their lives by renewing their minds, as Paul says from Romans 12, and not being conformed to the world, will they find joy on this restricted road down here? Oh yes, there's joy there. Absolutely. When you involve yourselves in the things of Christ and with other faithful brethren, there are some joyous times there. The joy of coming to worship. Some folks again say, well, that to me, that's boring. Well, but if your mind's where it ought to be, to come here and sing hymns together and pray and open the Lord's Word, that's a joyous time. And also, if they have their head screwed on straight, will they see anything really pleasurable up here? They'll see it for what it's worth, won't they? He's trying to reach the phone back there as quick as he can. Bless her heart. Okay. All right. So, again, see, it depends on your perspective. It depends on where your mind is, where your heart is, as to not whether or not you really realize that for what it is. So don't think that because we say, yes, this is difficult, it's hard, it's restricted, it cramps your style, that kind of thing. No, if you understand what's at play, what's at work, there are joys there. And they're meaningful. And they're really what matters. And Jesus says, I want you to travel that way. That's the invite. Someone said, that's not inviting to me. Well, you've got to change the way you think then. Thinking man's religion. Yes, Brother Lambert. Yes. No. Yes. Spiritual, reasonable. Yeah, that's right. That's where it's got to be. Okay, so we'll stop with this today, and we'll start next week then on chapter 7, verse 15 with the two fruits. The second of the four contrasts is imitation. The two fruits. Two roads first, then the two fruits. So thank you for your good comments. We may even finish up next week. I kind of doubt it, though, but we may. If not, then we should finish by the third Tuesday. That will be next week, won't it? The third Tuesday is next Tuesday. This is the second one, if my math is correct. Yes. We may finish up next week or may take some part of the last Tuesday, but we'll finish up before May ends, nonetheless. So thank you again for your good comments today.